they didn't have health insurance growing up. They weren't taken to the hospital as much as, like, you should have.
Signing up a hard-to-reach group for health insurance before time runs out. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
In the old days, you spent a lot of time at the patient's bedside, and now the common saying is that you spend more time with the computer.
You know, people will want to wait in my waiting room for me because it's me.
He was like, forget it, because I can't pay it out of pocket.
Trees can't move as fast as climate changes.
200 degrees is a lot more tolerable
than
one
would think.
When you think about it, a connected refrigerator
is actually a horrible idea.
He's the first who's saying the emperor has no clothes.
On today's show, lovebirds and bird lice, rock salt and ice melt, and the possibilities of growing champagne in England, thanks to climate change. But first up, this is the final weekend to sign up for health insurance through the Affordable Care Act's online marketplace, also known as Obamacare. Latinos are one of the groups that could really stand to benefit from this insurance option. They make up about one-third of the nation's uninsured. Even so, sign-ups have lagged. Alana Gordon reports on new strategies this time around to change that.
The second open enrollment period is shorter than last year's. It runs just 3 months and ends this weekend.
So we are in kind of like, we're juxtaposed between the auto show and then also the mall food court.
Jose Plaza stands near some tables where people are meeting with application counselors right in the lower level of Jefferson Station in Philadelphia. Plaza's here from D.C., helping out at one of the many outreach events during the final countdown to the enrollment deadline.
We're going to where the community is, and hence why we're here in the middle of the thoroughfare.
Plaza is National Director for Latino Engagement for Enroll America. He says connecting with people in person in places like this has been key to increasing signups, especially among Latinos. Enrollment has been lower around this region, and nationwide, Latinos make up a small portion of overall signups.
What we found was that there are a couple challenges when it came to language. Also, this cultural competence around health insurance and also understanding the benefits of health insurance.
For many, there's also the fear of drawing attention to family members who may be in the country illegally. In other cases, there's the unexpected paperwork involved with ID verification. Plaza says all of this has led to new strategies this year, simplifying language around health insurance, doing more in-person outreach with community groups, working with Spanish media outlets, and especially for younger generations, having some fun with social media. Think silly memes and bilingual hashtags.
Healthcare isn't a sexy subject matter for anyone, really, not even young people. But finding different ways of making it attractive is what's brought a lot of folks to click on the meme, and then we're able then to direct them to the website.
Plaza points to a viral video of a three-year-old arguing with his mom, who he calls by her first name, Linda, about having cupcakes for dinner.
No, you're not listening. I said no cupcakes, and you try to get cupcakes, and you try to ask grandma.
Linda,
didn't you?
Linda, lick it, lick it.
It worked because it was a young Latino kid who was in trouble.
For dinner.
Linda, like this thing, and I would be lost.
Plaza's group made their own healthcare meme featuring a picture of the boy with the caption, Linda, listen, honey, just go get coverage.
So it was just really, you know, comical.
Honey, look at this.
I'm done arguing with you.
I'm done arguing with you.
Plaza is hopeful all these efforts are having an impact. Exact numbers are hard to pin down, but federal estimates point to the Latino uninsured rate going down this year.
Latinos are around 32% of the total population that are uninsured, and we've seen that drop drastically also among young Latinos.
For 20-year-old Luis Ortiz, it wasn't the clever memes or hashtags that brought him here to Jefferson Station. It was an insistent roommate who actually helped set up this event.
He kind of like told me to come through and get health insurance because I really need it.
Had you thought about getting health insurance before him nudging you?
Actually, never. Like, it's not really the one thing on my mind when I'm thinking about things to get when I'm growing up.
Ortiz says his parents spent most of their lives without insurance, so if anyone ever got sick or hurt, the mindset was, it'll get better, it'll heal. Ortiz learned he's now eligible for Pennsylvania's new Medicaid option and is looking forward to seeing a doctor. As for Jose Plaza, Enroll America's Latino director, he's hoping as more people like Ortiz get coverage and experience the benefits, They'll tell their friends and family about it. And that word of mouth will serve as the real secret weapon for success in increasing enrollment in the months and years ahead. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. The honest truth is that I had never expected to stay this long, said FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg in an interview about the fact that she'll be leaving the agency at the end of March. Hamburg was nominated by President Obama in 2009. She's overseen the FDA for nearly 6 years. That's longer than anybody who was previously in that position. It's a huge and complicated job. The FDA regulates products that account for 20 cents of every dollar American spend. Joining us now to discuss what Hamburg's departure means is reporter Rachana Pradhan of Politico. Rachana, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, good to be with you.
What are some of Hamburg's biggest accomplishments during her tenure?
Over the last 6 years, the FDA has really undergone some pretty significant changes, not just with respect to reviewing drugs and medical devices, but also one of the biggest things that comes to mind, at least for me, is its role in overhauling food safety in our country and just also some other food-related policies that I think just more broadly the Obama administration has focused very heavily on.
So what are we talking about there? Trans fats? What else?
Right. So trans fats, trying to ban trans fats, certainly reducing them is one of the biggest things that the FDA has been involved in. One of the things that comes to mind is overhauling our food safety system. Currently, what's underway is the biggest overhaul since the 1930s. People have described it as a Herculean effort to do that. And right now, I think there might be some uncertainty because with Hamburg's departure, what impact her leaving will have on the agency to be able to do those things.
Now, Hamburg joked, and I think this is a bit of an older joke, that the FDA only has two speeds in approving medicines, too fast or too slow. But there were some efforts under her tenure to speed things up when needed, right?
There's one thing that she really had a hand in was developing what is called the breakthrough pathway. Now, the main motive of that is to make it so that drugs and devices are approved faster. So those with breakthrough technology. And oftentimes they're meant for getting products approved that really would help people that have very serious, even life-threatening illnesses.
Now, Rachana, there were also quite a few controversial issues under Hamburg's tenure. What were some of those?
One was that there was a fungal meningitis outbreak a few years back that ended up killing 64 people and making ill, you know, hundreds across the country. And that was linked to what's called a compounding pharmacy in Massachusetts. And Hamburg was really, really in the hot seat quite a lot, even in Congress. Her agency was under a lot of scrutiny in terms of the oversight that they have over these pharmacies and just in general how they work with states. Another controversial issue that the FDA has had to deal with during Commissioner Hamburg's tenure is the approval of the Plan B birth control pill to be over-the-counter. That decision was made in 2013 to make the pill available to all ages over-the-counter without a prescription. Before that, it was really only available over-the-counter for women ages 17 and older.
What happens next with the FDA? Who will step up to take over, at least for now?
So the commissioner, when she announced that she would be departing, in that note to her employees, she said that Dr. Steven Ostrov is going to be acting commissioner of the FDA. He's currently the chief scientist of the agency. However, another candidate who observers of the agency have noted is likely to take over, perhaps, or be the next commissioner is Robert Califf. He's a cardiologist by training, and he's at Duke University right now. And he was actually just recently named to be the FDA's deputy commissioner for medical products and tobacco.
I've heard from some people within the kind of medical field that they are not entirely happy about that possibility.
So Dr. Califf actually had been floated as a possibility in 2008 to head the FDA, but the reason that he was passed over was because of his close ties to the pharmaceutical industry, which, as you know, the FDA regulates along with other areas of our, the health sector. So at Duke, Dr. Califf was the founding director of this institute called the Duke Clinical Research Institute, and they're responsible for doing clinical trials for drug companies. So he's received many grants from pharmaceutical companies, and some people, I think, are concerned that his close ties to the industry are not appropriate for someone who is regulating them at the end of the day.
But again, he has not been formally announced yet, so much of this remains to be seen yet, right?
Right. This is just speculation on people's part, but Califf was named, less than a month before Hamburg announced that she was leaving. And I think many think that he was brought in mind to be the next head of the FDA.
Rachana, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Rachana Pradhan is a healthcare reporter with Politico. As we just heard, scientific and medical issues can and do turn into political footballs. Also think about global warming and, more recently, vaccines. But watch out, politicians. There's a new sheriff in town. SciCheck is a new branch of the website factcheck.org, which examines politicians' claims for accuracy. Now, SciCheck will do the same for statements related to science and medicine. David Levitan heads this new effort, and I stopped by his office to ask him how he goes about declaring politicians' claims true or false.
Basically, I do research on it. I talk to experts, read, a lot of literature from reputable sources, things like, peer-reviewed journals or government sources, things that are generally agreed to be good sources of data and information, as well as, confirming with experts in the field then.
What's your background?
I have been a science journalist in various forms for 10 or 11 years at this point. A lot of focus on environmental issues, energy, climate change, things like that. And I've written for a whole bunch of different outlets, from Scientific American to the Philadelphia Inquirer, all over the place, really.
What do you predict will be some of the big topics as we go into an election cycle?
Well, the big ones are probably going to be ones we've already heard about a bunch in recent years. Climate change is certainly high on the list, and there is obviously some disagreement in political circles about it. So that's certainly one I'll be keeping my eye on. Some others, maybe energy-related topics, such as fracking for natural gas, which is, of course, a big topic in Pennsylvania in particular. Public health questions like vaccines have been in the news a lot recently. Those are some of the big ones, probably.
Can you give me an example of a claim that you recently investigated and how you went about checking it and what came out?
Sure. So in a speech President Obama gave announcing something he's calling the Precision Medicine Initiative, which is a new program basically designed to spur new treatments for cancer or just other diseases as well, trying to sort of increase the hit rate on treatments for diseases. He cited some numbers about the Human Genome Project and its benefit to society in terms of economic impact, which he wasn't wrong. There is a study saying what he said, but that study had been updated with a new sort of methodology, which lowered the number. It's a very tough thing to sort of really establish the impact of a program like the Human Genome Project. But he probably overstated the benefits a little bit, so we went in and looked at all the various versions of that study and tried to establish what was the more useful number.
Dave, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
David Levitan heads SciCheck. It's a new branch of factcheck.org. He will check politicians' claims about health and science topics for accuracy. Coming up on The Pulse, a few times recently we got no snow, but 3 inches of salt all around. There are ways to use salt more efficiently.
The next time it potentially snows, that is what's going to save you from the black ice, from the slippery concrete, from the slippery surface.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence believes in living like nothing can hold you down. But to live worry-free, you need someone to fall back on. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. Independence is here to help. This year, you may be eligible for financial support. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. More information at IBX.com or 1-800-ASK-BLUE.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca promotes health and science education and disease awareness through initiatives such as the Young Health Program, which helps young people build personal qualities to live healthy, successful lives. Launched in the U.S. in partnership with the United Way of Delaware, the Young Health Program has reached nearly 12,000 young people since 2012. More about the Young Health Program can be found online at im40.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Each winter, the city of Philadelphia uses 20 to 40,000 tons of rock salt to keep its roads ice-free. In a bad season, like last year, that number can balloon to more than 80,000 tons. And that's just one city, and that huge number doesn't include you and me throwing a thick coat of salt on our sidewalk every time we see a little bit of snow. But not all salts are created equal. Jessica McDonald reports.
To understand the power of salt, first consider ice formation. As the temperature falls, water molecules slow down and are more likely to meet up. At 32 degrees Fahrenheit, they snap into place within a beautiful repeating pattern of hexagons. Drexel chemical engineer Nicholas Alvarez says salt works because when it dissolves, it disrupts this process.
If you think about this in terms of water needs to see nearby molecules in order to freeze. If you can put an atom in between water molecules, then you're preventing it from finding its nearest neighbor and forming crystals.
In the case of rock salt, which is just table salt or sodium chloride, there's one atom of sodium and one atom of chlorine to do this disrupting. The way it's used on most sidewalks, it's able to lower the freezing point to 25 degrees. That's why rock salt doesn't help much when temperatures really plunge, and it's why it can also pose a problem for concrete. Concrete is porous and allows a certain amount of water and any dissolved salt inside. If the temperature drops just 7 degrees, then it will freeze and expand.
And that puts huge stresses on the concrete. And you can actually see, if you walk down the street, you'll see little pits that have formed on your sidewalk or on your driveways. And that's usually because of the stresses from the ice freezing inside the concrete.
Another salt, calcium chloride, can avoid those damaging freeze-thaw cycles because it lowers the freezing temperature much more, to minus 25 degrees. That's primarily because whereas sodium chloride has just two atoms to do its work, calcium chloride has three. There's an extra chlorine to squeeze in and destabilize ice. And Alvarez says it offers another bonus.
Calcium chloride is a much more exothermic process, which means that it gives off heat when it dissolves into water, so it melts the ice faster.
That speed and lower effective temperature, however, come with a price tag that's about double that of rock salt. So most large-scale operations, including the city of Philadelphia, rely solely on sodium chloride. Decades of heavy use have taken a toll on the environment because salt doesn't just wash away. Stuart Findlay, an aquatic biologist with the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies, says sodium chloride levels remain elevated into the summer months, right when organisms are most vulnerable.
The amphibians, you know, that inhabit, you know, lakes, streams, and ponds in the Northeast U.S. are not used to any salt concentration. And the young stages of these organisms actually breathe across their skin. That's how they get oxygen. So any chemical that's dissolved in the water, they're very, very sensitive to that.
Another option is calcium magnesium acetate. It's sometimes used in special places such as bridges because it won't eat away at metal or add sodium chloride to waterways. But it's far more expensive and can still be harmful to the environment because it depletes oxygen in water. The real trick is to use less salt. One way for homeowners to cut back, says chemical engineer Nicholas Alvarez, is to pay attention to the physical shape of salt.
Well, if it's a very rocky crystalline structure like you would get from rock salt, then you can have situations where the bulk of the material is not in contact with the ice.
Smoother pellets will dissolve more quickly and work faster. But by far the most efficient delivery of salt over an entire surface is a brine solution. It coats evenly and won't be blown away by wind. That's essentially what the salty residue left on the streets will become.
The next time it potentially snows, that is what's going to save you from the black ice, from the slippery concrete, from the slippery surface.
For The Pulse, I'm Jessica McDonald.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. It appears that Americans are becoming more unified on the issue of climate change and more supportive of governmental action to reduce carbon emissions. Why the change in attitudes? Well, perhaps everybody read a recent in-depth report on BuzzFeed titled How Climate Change Will End Wine as We Know It. Do we have your attention now? Joining us to talk about the effects of climate change on wine growing is BuzzFeed news reporter Sandra Allen. She wrote this piece. Sandra, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Sandra, the title of your article is bold. It's a bit scary. What do you mean by the end of wine as we know it?
I'm being a little tricky with the as we know it, admittedly. The big story here is that climate change is going to bring about a lot of ends for wine worldwide. And then the as we know it is tricky because there's also the silver lining to this story, which is regions that were formerly too cold to produce wine reliably, like Tasmania or British Columbia or England, where I actually did some reporting for this story, are now potentially going to have viable wine regions.
The report you quote in your article gives a very broad range of the potential decrease of wine regions between 25 and over 70%. So why this really broad range?
So the study I'm referencing was published in 2013 by the Proceedings for the National Academy of Sciences. And the estimation is broad, I think, because it two things. There's the difference in the carbon emission scenario. So there's kind of the business as usual numbers, and then there's the if things continue to get worse numbers. But second, there is a tension between what people who actually work in grape growing and winemaking would perceive to be going on and what wine grapes can tolerate is debatable. And winemakers are always adapting year to year. Grape growers are always adapting. There's technology that can help people adapt to change.
What are some wine growers doing already to adapt to new challenges, and what could they potentially do in the future?
One thing that's definitely happening already is winemakers can look at the kind of varietal, so basically which grape they're growing. So if you were growing Pinot Noir in your vineyard and it's getting hotter, maybe you make the decision to replant with Cabernet Sauvignon. One of the reasons that wine is of interest to climate scientists who want to look at agriculture and what it's up against in terms of climate change is that wine is really slow moving. So if I wanted to change my vineyard over, I can't just do that overnight or in a single season. That's going to take years before I've converted to a different kind of wine grape. And then there's the question of quality. So if a given wine region is known, if it's built its entire, you know, viticulture off of a particular grape, so we could use an old world example like Burgundy's, you know, built its entire identity around Pinot Noir. Burgundian winemakers know Pinot Noir, and for them to just switch to another grape would almost be completely unheard of. It would be like changing cuisines. And then the last thing that wine producers can do and already are doing, and I open with an anecdote about an Australian producer. They had a really bad drought in 2008. It was very hot. The company made the decision, sort of as a result of that, to purchase a bunch of viable viticultural area in Tasmania, an island south of Australia, which is previously too cold to reliably produce fine wine, but now is becoming more friendly to wine. And so producers are sort of looking at the world map and are seeing places like England or British Columbia or Tasmania as potential places to invest.
Now, Sandra, I'm sure scientists and wine growers observe climate in different ways. What did the wine growers say to you about how they perceive this threat to their livelihood and how bad they think it is, essentially?
I think in general, people didn't think it was that bad, which seems pretty human to me. The folks I spoke with in Australia were the most frank and kind of open about acknowledging that things have gotten hot and things have gotten dry. And in some areas, there won't be a lot of change, at least right away. And in some areas, that change might not take the shape of just things being hotter. It might take the shape of erratic weather, for example, or an increased instance of big weather events like hail or like flooding. And really, as I write in the piece, one of the worst things for winemakers is unpredictability. You have one shot to harvest, and then you begin the winemaking process and then eventually aging and bottling. And you're hopefully trying to really capture the very best of what that geography and that climate has to offer. So grape growers and winemakers, their whole livelihood is built off of an understanding of how a very particular place works in concert with a very particular weather pattern.
And finally, from your reporting, are there any specific varietals that are especially threatened? Anything I should stock up on, so to say?
Anything to stock up on? No, not specific varietals. I mean, I used Pinot Noir as an example before, in part because it is a notoriously finicky grape. I would say the things to stock up on would be your huge, big-bodied reds, especially Old World reds, because those are going to be the things that are threatened first. So wines from the Iberian Peninsula or Italy or southern France, Australian Shiraz, and then what we're going to be seeing more of as these kind of cooler climates become more viable for winemaking are more sparkling wines and aromatic white wines and things like that. So like in England, for example, the big, and Tasmania actually, but the big products are becoming sparkling wines. So one thing you're definitely going to see is the English making a really intense play to compete with champagne when it comes to the sparkling wine game.
Well, cheers. Sandra, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Sandra Allen is deputy features editor for BuzzFeed News, and she recently wrote an article titled How Climate Change Will End Wine as We Know It.
I'm praying for rain in California so that grapes can grow and they can make more wine.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Birds are beautiful. I'm sure we can all agree on that. The parasites that live in and on birds? Ooh, not so much, right? But they are a huge fascination for Jason Weckstein. He is Associate Curator of Ornithology at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University. And in this week's edition of So What Do You Do?, Weckstein explained to writer and science fan Chris Norwood what he finds when he ruffles some feathers. Norwood asked Weckstein,
"So what do you do?"
"Well, I am an avian evolutionary biologist and also a parasitologist. I kind of can wear multiple hats. The primary parasites that I work on are lice, chewing lice, that live on the feathers of birds. They're a lot like the head lice that live on humans. They're related to those. So the statistic I like to sort of throw out there is that 30 to 70% of life on Earth is parasitic. So there's a lot of life out there that's parasitic, and we don't know a lot about that segment of life. And birds have a whole suite of different kinds of parasites living on them and in them.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's hard to even know whether these we call them symbionts. They're these organisms that live in and on inside and outside of hosts. Mm-hmm. It's hard to even know, are they having a negative impact? Is it a mutualistic relationship?
Yeah.
Because we don't have the data. We haven't studied them well enough. Mm-hmm. So for chewing lice, this group that I work on, we know that from the groups that have been studied, they do have negative impacts on the host. And those negative impacts are they reduce the reproductive success of those hosts. So when they nest, they don't have as many young, or they don't nest as successfully. They may not survive the winter as well because basically the lice chew the bases of the downy feathers that help to insulate these birds from the cold.
Are birds just overall dirty? Because there is a perception that, you know, like if you see a dead bird, you should not touch it. If you touch a hawk's talons, that's just, you know,
filthy.
Very, very filthy.
Well, you know, I don't want to like encourage the whole community out there to go and touch a bunch of birds, but you know, I mean, I'm an ornithologist, so I handle birds all the time. I don't worry about it. You know, I usually wash my hands before I eat a meal after I've handled a bird.
Absolutely.
Are they filthy with parasites? Yes. Are those parasites that are going to cause a problem for the two of us? No. Over long periods of evolutionary time, we know there are, you know, switches of parasites between host groups. So that's, you know, avian influenza, you know, can switch on to people in theory, right?
Yes.
And the same is true of, you know, over evolutionary time, humans got their plasmodium, which is the parasite that causes malaria, we got that from other animals, presumably. So it was passed on to us by a mosquito biting a human, and that plasmodium was able to survive and then reproduce in humans, and voila, we have a human disease, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of diseases and parasites ultimately come from wild animals.
In our close contact.
Yeah, in our close contact over long periods of evolutionary time, usually. Is a louse going to do that? No. These lice are so specific to feathers and living their life on feathers, and they're permanent parasites. Mm-hmm. In other words, they live their entire life cycle on that host, and that's what makes them great for the evolutionary biology sort of stuff that I do. Basically, if one of those crawls onto you, mm-hmm. it's going to fall off. It can't even hang on to human skin and hair.
So with all the research that you've done and that you're continuing to do, what do you hope to get out of all the things that you're discovering and all the things that you're learning about birds and parasites?
Well, I mean, I'm hoping that, you know, in the end, we gain a better understanding of the biodiversity on our planet. As a whole, my research, you know, a lot of it is focused on trying to understand sort of what are the correlates of evolutionary history, like what things lead to particular patterns in evolutionary history. So understanding those kinds of questions helps us understand just in general how these different kinds of ecologies can lead to different patterns of diversification. And from the parasite perspective, the importance of that is understanding, you know, how host switching happens.
Right.
You know, how do parasites go from being specific to one thing to being found on another, or being generalists? And that has, you know, that has big implications for understanding the evolutionary biology, but also for understanding the transmission biology. Like, how do these parasites and pathogens transmit, and how does that change over evolutionary time?
Thanks for talking to me and explaining what you do.
Thanks for having me.
Writer Christopher Norwood speaking with Academy of Natural Sciences ornithologist Jason Weckstein. Do you want to be part of our So What Do You Do series? Tweet us at WHYY The Pulse. Coming up, a love affair that forever changed OR procedures.
The nurse in charge of my operating room complained that the solution of mercuric chloride produced a dermatitis of her arms and hands.
I promise it gets more romantic than dermatitis. Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse and believes that everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. More at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations to increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region, AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. In the tradition of Grey's Anatomy and ER, a new TV show portrays the intense drama of an American hospital. The series is called The Nick, and it's set in grimy New York City in 1900. It introduces a brilliant doctor played by Clive Owen, who happens to be addicted to cocaine.
There's no one like Thackeray. To work with a surgeon of his genius, it's
intoxicating.
The show is on Cinemax, so there are lots of sexy scenes between a young nurse and the dashing chief surgeon, and the lead character is inspired by an actual physician. For Valentine's Day, Tanya English visited Johns Hopkins University to get the real story of how a romantic gesture may have changed operating rooms across America.
Behind a locked heavy door at Hopkins Hospital, there's a shrine of sorts to a man who privately struggled with drug addiction, while at the same time building a career so prolific that he became the father of modern surgery in America.
It's called the William Halstead Museum.
Neil Grauer is the de facto historian at Hopkins Medicine.
This is a partly wood-paneled room which largely is furnished with antiques that belong to Halstead.
Here you can see a beautiful top hat. It must be 5-6 inches high.
That's Ralph Rubon. He made a documentary film about Halstead.
And then his scarf and coat. So you can imagine an impeccably dressed, serious senior Dr. Halstead.
Dr. Halstead was bald, had a, kind of a walrus mustache. He had pince-nez glasses. Those are small, rimless glasses that, you know, pinch on the nose.
When Dr. Halstead disapproved of one of his young surgeons, he'd stare over the top of his glasses. But a certain scrub nurse, Caroline Hampton, grabbed Halstead's attention in a good way. And one of the hospital founders noticed the two of them.
You know, kind of in a corner, chatting very amiably, and he said, aha, I suspect romance is brewing.
Hampton was the wealthy niece of a Confederate general. She looks prim and demure in her white nurse's uniform. But Rubin says for those times, Hampton was an uncommonly independent woman.
And these are Halstead's words. In the winter of 1889 and 1890, I cannot recall the month, the nurse in charge of my operating room complained that the solution of mercuric chloride produced a dermatitis of her arms and hands. As she was an unusually efficient woman, and I love that word for anyone's wife, an unusually efficient woman, I gave the matter my consideration.
Caroline did become Halstead's wife, but before that, the surgeon sent exacting specifications to the Goodyear Rubber Company to have gloves made for her. At the museum, a pair of gloves from that time is preserved under plastic.
It looks much more like a big gauntlet, doesn't it? If you put your hand over it, you can see how large and thick these must have been. And it's hard to imagine operating with one of these.
At the beginning of the 20th century, doctors performed surgery bare-knuckled, literally up to their elbows in blood and guts.
How brutal and dramatic that must have been to leave the operating room with hands covered with blood and all the infectious diseases they may have. Everyone prior to that was doing the same thing every day and never stepping back and thinking about how things can be done differently.
Historian Neil Grauer says it was years before it dawned on most doctors that those gloves could help slow the spread of infection and save lives.
But he was so prominent that when it became generally known that he wore gloves, well, the style was duplicated.
So that's the story. A thoughtful gift from Dr. Halstead to his soon-to-be wife made rubber surgical gloves popular all across America. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
From hospital lovebirds to bird love. How is that for a transition? Hornbills are a family of birds that live in Asia and Africa. They can be black or gray and range in size from 1 to 3 feet. One thing nearly every member of the hornbill family has in common, though, is a peculiar nesting behavior that's unique in the animal kingdom. Carolyn Beeler reports.
A preening pair of rhinoceros hornbills are the first thing you see when you walk into the McNeil Avian Center at the Philadelphia Zoo.
That's Bob, the male there, and that's Nancy, the female. She's a little bit smaller than he is. My name is Dr. Aliza Baltz, and I'm the curator of birds.
The pair is sitting on a vine that's bowing under their weight. The male's at least 4 feet tall. Both are mostly black with white legs and striped tails that flash when they fly. Their beaks are huge. They look kind of like toucans. They're orange and yellow, but they have an extra horn-like piece that gives the species its name. It looks almost like another half beak perched on top of the regular one.
Yeah, it's called a casque. Looks like a really heavy structure, but it's actually hollow, so it's fairly lightweight. They think it helps to amplify the sound, that call you were just hearing. That call can carry up to several kilometers away, so even if they're in really dense forests and they can't see their partner, they can still hear them. They can call to each other.
In the wild, they build their homes in holes in trees. But the craziest thing about hornbills is what happens around mating time.
The female actually goes into the nest when she's ready to lay eggs, and she muds herself in. She seals herself basically into the nest.
She leaves a tiny opening the size of her mate's beak.
And he feeds her throughout the whole course of when she's incubating the eggs and rearing the chicks.
All day, every day, the male flies around looking for food and bringing it back to the nest. The female rhinoceros hornbill stays in those cramped quarters for about a month and a half. And while she's in there, she molts her wing and tail feathers all at once, leaving her completely dependent on her mate.
If something happens to him, she's out of luck too because she no longer has her flight feathers. So if she comes out of the nest, she's pretty vulnerable. She can't really fly away from predators, and it's difficult for her to, you know, access food.
So here's my question. Is this a case of ultimate paternal devotion or of an overly jealous husband? Early biologists thought it was jealousy.
In the 1800s, a famous British naturalist wrote that the male imprisoned the female in a kind of tower of purity. By the 1930s, a paper noted correctly that it's actually the female who builds most of the seal, and she's, quote, not in any way compelled by the male to shut herself in. Still, the question of who has the upper hand in hornbill relationships and why they build these nest seals, it's a source of debate. Mark Standback, a biologist at Davidson College in North Carolina, says while most birds have long been thought of as monogamous, recent DNA testing of their chicks has proven they're actually not.
We now know that in most cases, female birds are happy to cheat on their spouses to get higher quality genes for their offspring.
The hornbill female can store sperm in her body for up to a month. So even though she's sequestered during egg laying, she could still cheat beforehand. So Standback developed a theory. The sealed nest wasn't so much a chastity belt as an implicit threat for the female from the male.
I put a spell on you.
You get knocked up by someone else before you enter the nest, he says, I stop feeding you and the chicks.
Because you're mine.
But while researching hornbills in Namibia, Standback realized females would never molt their flight feathers if there was a chance they'd be abandoned. So he sees the nest sealing not as a way to keep the females in, but as a way to keep everyone else out.
The sealing of the female into the nest, I think, is predator-driven. By having this closed-up hole with just a small gap in it, it makes the female and the eggs and chicks much safer from predators.
Now that's the predominant theory, but there is at least one other. Margaret Kennard wrote a 2007 book on Asian hornbills. Now she's the executive director of the Impala Research Center in northern Kenya, where I reached her on Skype.
I'm actually sitting in my house right now where the broadband internet is better than at my office. And I'm looking out onto my salt lick where there is a reticulated giraffe licking salt.
When Kennard started her hornbill research, she, like Standback, thought the birds were sealing their nests against predators.
But where I studied, there were very, very few predators. And so we started thinking about different things that it might be.
The theory she landed on, maybe the seal is the female's way to keep the male faithful.
So if the female seals herself in and the male has to provide all of the food for both himself and her growing chicks, he's not going to have time to provision another nest.
If the female were feeding the babies, her mate would have time to fool around.
But in this case, he's going to lose his entire reproductive investment if he doesn't keep on feeding, because she has said, hey, man, deliver me the bonbons because I'm sitting in here all closed up.
Kennard's theory has been criticized for downplaying the predator factor, but she stands behind it.
When you read some of the literature, mainly the popular literature, the old literature on, oh, the male hornbill does the equivalent of putting a chastity belt on the female hornbill. How is what I'm saying any more extreme? It's just what we're used to hearing. The male is always in control.
However this nest-sealing behavior developed, hornbills have evolved into an unusually monogamous species. On his research in Namibia, Mark Standback tested the paternity of 135 hornbill chicks.
So it was 100%. There were no mismatched babies in the analyses we did.
Does this faithfulness and lifetime monogamy sort of warm your heart or no, because they're birds?
No, I would say it warms my heart. In many ways, because we now recognize that conflict is such a big part of animal behavior and the battle of the sexes, we sometimes overlook the importance of cooperation in enhancing individual organisms' personal fitness.
In other words, sometimes faithfulness does pay off. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Do Valentine's Day roses, chocolates, and poetic cards spell nothing but ennui for you? Perhaps your romantic side would be better served with a health policy Valentine. Say what? Joining us now is Emma Sandow. She is a PhD student in health policy at Harvard, and she started this whole campaign up on Twitter. Emma, what exactly are we talking about?
Well, a couple years ago, I was on my way home, and I
thought about Valentine's Day. It was, I think, about February 11th or 12th, and I thought about all the funny jokes that you can make with health policy and Valentine's. So I just tweeted a bunch, and then it caught on, and people kept tweeting them for days. It was great.
And the hashtag is health policy Valentine's, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty long, so you have to keep your tweet short, right?
Yep.
So we took a couple of them off Twitter and did some dramatic readings with them. So let's hear them.
My dearest ICD-10 coder, Cupid has pierced my heart with his arrow. Code W45.8XXA. Signed, American Medical Association.
Much like the Obamacare enrollment, my love for you increased 53% in January. Signed, Ninjas for Health.
My love for you is like an accountable care organization. Hard to define, but I know it's there. Signed, Alicia Samuels.
Emma, what are some of your favorites from past Valentine's days?
Oh, gosh. I like the ones that are as nerdy as possible. There's a couple about Medicaid 1115 waivers, but I think my favorite one was Medicare doesn't cover long-term care, but I do.
Who participates in this?
Oh, gosh. There's a pretty great community of health policy nerds on Twitter, and they're on there every year, but it's grown into a nationwide bunch of people that I have never met.
So, Emma, does this start up on Saturday and then continue through the weekend?
I've seen it continuing for a couple weeks sometimes. It depends how much of a love mood people are in.
Emma Sandow, thank you so much. Happy Valentine's Day. Emma is a PhD student in public health at Harvard University. And here's one more before we go.
Girl, I'm trying to keep readmission rates low, but you keep walking back into my heart. Signed, Patrick Ross.
Emma, thank you so much.
Thank you. Happy Valentine's Day.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Avery Brookins is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our associate producer. Megan Pinto is the executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news. And Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody. And how is this? Baby, your love is addictive, but not as addictive as the added sugar that permeates almost our entire food supply. That was too much. If this goes anywhere, you're dead. Hashtag health policy Valentine's.